Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
If everyone on the other side of this argument in our society could just read this book, it is about her specific family. And it's about Vietnam and the Vietnam War. And there's something special and unique to how focused it is. But this is the same story as someone leaving Honduras or Guatemala. Every American has some piece of this in their heritage. It's such an American story.
Welcome to Modern Minorities.
This is a show about work and life, told through the lens of what makes each of us different.
I'm Sharon Lee Tony, a Chinese-American girl born and raised in New York City.
And I'm Raman Segal, an Indian-American boy who came from Alabama with a banjo on my knee.
Through conversations with some really interesting people, we uncover the stories, perspectives, and often unspoken truths about how our guests uniquely experience the world.
It doesn't matter where you're from, the color of your skin, or who you love, we're all minorities somehow. But we're no one's model minority.
This is a show about all of you for all of us. For AAPI Heritage Month, we wanted to share a mix of conversations that bring the Asian American experience to life in powerful ways. Even though we try to be more of an American podcast, featuring lots of minority voices for all our majority ears, sometimes we just gotta lean into the Asian side of things. And as you already know by now, Raman can't help bring up his love of comics in every conversation he's a part of. I'll admit, I was always a little bit skeptical about his comics geekery. I used to think that comics were only about the superheroes and capes that we see in movies. But I've come to discover and appreciate they are so much more, a powerful storytelling medium just like TV and film. So this month, we wanted to do something special. Sharing some past conversations about some of the best Asian American comics and comic book creators out there. Honestly, getting to talk about and with creators whose works moved us is one of the perks of our show. Maybe you heard these before, or at least have heard us talking about them, but if you enjoy these conversations, please be sure to show your support by picking up their work wherever you get your favorite books. Got a suggestion for something we should check out? Email us at himom@modmypod.com. We'd love to hear from you. So, first up is T. Bowie's The Best We Could Do, a book that broke our heart and put it back together. Back in 2020, I joined Raman's other podcast, Quarantine Comics, where things got pretty deep for Ryan, Raman, and me. T. Bowie is an author I really want to talk to, which I hope to make happen one day. If any of you know her, please do let her know about our podcast and that we're big fans. So let's jump right in for our Quarantine Comics chat about T. Bowie's The Best We Could Do.
Welcome to Quarantine Comics, where we talk about some really good things that you should have already read.
This entire podcast is actually a spoiler.
I'm Raman Segal.
And I'm Ryan Joe, and we're two wild and crazy guys who don't know much, but for the next 45 minutes, we'll pretend we do.
So this week, we're actually getting a little heavy. And we're going to talk about The Best We Can Do, T. Bowie's illustrated memoir of her family's history in exodus from Vietnam to America. This is Bowie's first graphic novel from 2017, and it's a moving one. It covers love, war, and the refugee's journey, with a really intimate focus on one family, her own. And rather than simply retelling her own memories, which are shown through the eyes of a scared little girl, Bowie also chooses to illustrate the stories of her parents from their youth in Vietnam to the estranged present in America. As she says, proximity and closeness are not the same. If you want to better see the Vietnam War from the perspective of one Vietnamese family and feel what so many immigrants endure, I cannot recommend a better book to start your own journey. I accidentally discovered this book at the library a couple years ago, and as the cover said, it broke my heart and kind of put it back together. So joining us tonight is my longtime friend and not a dude, Sharon Lee Tony.
I am not a dude.
Not a dude. Sharon is a fellow child of immigrants and my co-hostess with the mostest on my other podcast, Modern Minorities. So Sharon, welcome to Quarantine Comics.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. And I have to say, I'm so not a comic book fan that when you guys invited me to join you, I was thinking, great, I can read a 20-page graphic comic about superheroes. And in the mail, I got this very heavy memoir that really did, it broke my heart too, and put it back together. That's very poetic. So good to be here.
Well, Sharon, tell us a little bit more about you. Beyond being just a child of Chinatown, it sounds like you don't read a lot of comic books. What's your relationship with fiction? What are some of your favorite stories?
You know, it's funny. I don't read a ton anymore. I think growing up, I enjoyed all the typical things that you get from Scholastic Book Club, the Babysitter's Club, and things like that. And then in my adult years, kind of perused through the New York Times bestsellers. I think in the most recent past, I read a lot of business books. I've been doing a lot of audiobooks lately, so I really loved Michelle Obama's Becoming, which everyone has probably listened to at this point. And lately, I've discovered a very – I don't even remember how I discovered him. I know my husband had recommended him, and maybe he heard about him through a friend. But Wallace Wattles, who wrote a series of books about 100 years ago, so in 1911 – and it's all these really interesting life philosophy type of things. So he's got one called The Science of Being Rich. And then he has another one called The Secret to Perfect Health. And then he has a third one that I haven't gotten to yet. But I've been listening to those as audiobooks. And it's fascinating to me that something that this man believed in 100 years ago is still very applicable today.
On our other podcast, we asked the guests, oh, what's the last good book or movie you've seen that kind of relates to the conversation we just had on race? And 9 times out of 10, you've actually read the book and I haven't.
Yeah, because most of them are saying things like The Alchemist.
Which I still haven't read.
Yeah, which you need to read.
3 guests have brought it up now.
Yeah. But my relationship to comic books. So I live in a family of 3 other boys or men. So my husband and my 2 boys, and they are so into comics and they know so much about all of them, whether it's DC or Marvel. My kids get the Spider-Man U to death. You guys probably know more than they do, but like literally Spider-Man trivia up and down like crazy. And then a little bit of Batman too. So those are kind of their 2 areas of expertise.
So Sharon, I was just actually wondering about your experience reading The Best We Could Do, because you said you haven't read a lot of comics. And I would guess that your conception of comics is mostly superheroes, maybe the comic strips, Snoopy or Calvin and Hobbes. And so you get something like this, and it's a lot heavier. It's the sort of story that's usually delivered in prose, but in this case, T. Bowie did it graphically. What was your reaction? Do you think it was different from if you had read it through text?
I think it actually punctuated the emotion of it for me, because I opened it up. I didn't know anything about this book besides the fact that she was also featured in the top 21 list of Asian American creators to follow in Huffington Post with us. So I was like,
oh, that's right. When that list came out, I was like, yes, I've read these 3.
And I was like, I better start reading these. So when you guys chose this, I was pretty excited. I didn't realize it was going to be such a thick book, because it's 327 pages. And I literally thought I was going to read a comic book, which was 20 pages. So I think what I enjoyed about this was I opened it up thinking it was going to be very similar to Calvin and Hobbes or Spider-Man. And lo and behold, within the first 5 pages, she is giving birth to a baby. And I think for me, opening on childbirth was actually something that really hooked me in, because I completely related to her experience of having that be such a pivotal thing in my own life too. Like the moment that you give birth to a human, everything changes. Just everything. Everything about your own understanding of what your body can do. So like physically that changes, but spiritually and emotionally that changes. And she did such a beautiful job of expressing that in such a nuanced, complex way that then kind of set up the rest of the story of her own history.
Well, the nuance was the humanity of it. It was the, I don't know what I'm doing. Like, I think her first thoughts are, please don't fall. Please don't fall.
Yeah.
It's a really human moment beyond this majestic Hollywood kind of moment.
Absolutely. So you guys picked the perfect book for me, I think. I was like, oh, I can get with this.
It's all downhill from here, Sharon.
I thought it was going to be like Wonder Woman stuff. And I was like, oh no, this is real. There are boobs and private parts.
Ryan, speaking of boobs and private parts, what did you think?
Yeah, you know, I actually really love this book. When you first recommended it to me, I looked at the cover and I kind of was turned off by it, because the cover looks like some celebrity book club pick of the month.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It doesn't do a good job showing how powerful T. Bowie is as an illustrator. I wish that they gave her a carte blanche to just design the cover rather than have some in-house marketer do it. But T. Bowie's art is fantastic. And the way she tells the story, you can see her getting her bearings. Initially, it took me a while to get into it. The first chapter was great when she's talking about the childbirth, the process of having brought this life into the world, but also all of the things that happened to her body, all of the nuances, all of the uncertainty. That stuff was amazing to see depicted. And then she starts going into the backstory of her own family. Mm-hmm. And that's where I felt she was still feeling out who she is as a visual storyteller. For instance, when she introduces her siblings, she kind of lists them all. And she gives her dates of birth, but it's not chronological. And I was wondering, okay, so why did you do that? Was it because, in much the same way, T herself had to piece together the story of her family? That was a lot of years of work. It was probably really confusing at times. She probably had to piece together some contradictions from different people. I mean, or did she just, or is she trying to kind of create that sensation for the readers? Or was it just a mistake where she just gave the information out in a way that wasn't particularly easy to read? And I'm not entirely sure. It doesn't really matter because soon after, you see her really just mature as a storyteller. And she's just great at creating both, telling both her mother and her father's side, kind of showing who she knows them to be, and then showing why they are the way they are and how they met and how the family started to come to be. I mean, that was really, when after I read the book, what was really striking to me, it was this unpacking of the immigrant, of her particular immigrant experience. And she's kind of tracing some of the habits that they have today, kind of back to really their constant need to escape, the fact that they're constantly on uncertain ground due to the volatility in Vietnam.
Yeah, you know, this book, I'm guessing the reason I found it at the library, it was 2017 and it had just come out. So it was a new release. It was featured. And it and so I grabbed it because anytime I see a comic book that doesn't look like superheroes that's featured somewhere, I'm like, it probably must be good. And if we flash back, it's hard to flash back to 2017 because it's been a really fucking long 3 years. But this was when they were locking kids up in cages at the border. And I remember reading it the first time and I cried as I was reading it multiple times. It was a really hard book for me to get through because we were all so emotionally raw. And I remember thinking, it's like, if everyone on the other side of this argument in our society could just read this book. And it's not, it is about her specific family and it's about Vietnam and the Vietnam War, but, and there's something special and unique to how focused it is, but this is the same story as someone leaving Honduras or Guatemala in the caravan or whatever. Right. And it's just like to understand, and again, that every American has some piece of this in their heritage. And this is like it's such an American story to me, even though it is a Vietnamese story, right? Yeah.
But I think that's also what makes it special, the fact that it is a Vietnamese story, because we see a lot of immigrant stories told from the point of view of Italians or other, usually whiter races, right? Mm-hmm. Every time you hear a story about the Vietnam War, it's always from the perspective of the Americans. And I think Bowie brings this up, that much of the depictions of Vietnam really comes from America.
Well, fun fact. So my first time going to Vietnam back in 07 or 08, you know what they call it there? They call it the American War. Like, that's what they call the war. Because they had a French War, they had a Chinese War, they had an American War. It's not the Vietnam War to them.
That's interesting. That's kind of pounds home the fact that, as if we didn't already know, but there are a lot of different perspectives out there. And sometimes we just overlook some of the richest perspectives because we... I put "we" in quotation marks, just kind of speaking as an American.
Yeah, it's "we." I'm guilty. Seriously, going back to that trip, I kind of knew the Vietnam War was a thing. I think it was a war that we lost. I kind of didn't pay attention in history class because it was a bit of a footnote in our history. Some really good.
Because it was a war that America lost.
Yeah, seriously. And then I'm reading The Lonely Planet on the flight over, and my wife and I were in Ho Chi Minh, and we went to the War Museum. And to just see their depiction of it. And it's a great, great country, great people, awesome food, beautiful scenery. Just like, it's one of my top five places in the world. And we fucked them over. And there's another book. There's a graphic illustration of, I think, the People's History of the United States or something like that, that we should read, Ryan. But it's, one thing I read about this two things I read about this book between readings, the first time and then for this, is they talk, there's a chapter called The Chessboard, and someone was like, I wish she had called it that, because it's like putting all these pieces of her family together, moving them on the board in this like circuitous kind of way. But the other thing, to come back to the art, was the simplicity of the art. And when I say simplicity, it's very complex and nuanced, but she makes it look easy. But if you look at like, the way she draws faces, it's a very simplistic, not hyper-realistic, not a Jim Lee kind of style, Ryan. And I think you emote more with the characters because of that. I feel like I'm putting my own emotions into reading these simple expressions.
Well, she's very economical, like with her line work and with her brush work, just aesthetically. I'm looking at page 50 right now, where she has both these landscapes, then she got the shots of this caravan full of people stumbling over the rocky pathways, and you got a close-up of the mother's face. Yeah, she's extremely versatile. That's the other thing I'd want to bring up. She's very good at creating an array of different moods, an array of different tones, and not a lot of artists can do that.
Yeah, and she is really great at also kind of showing the intimacy between the characters, or the dissonance between them too. So,
yeah, that's such a good word, you know, with the parents and stuff. Yeah.
She's very good at that.
Actually, I'm just looking at what you brought up, Sharon. On page 52, she talks about the birth of, I think, the oldest baby girl who eventually dies. But the way she does it, she shows the shot of the baby girl and the mother holding her, but she kind of divides it into two panels, which is actually very, very symbolic and very appropriate given what ultimately happens, the tragedy that happens.
Yeah, she's an amazing storyteller.
I got to ask both of you guys. So, I mean, we're all Asians. I'm South Asian, Indian, and you guys are both Chinese American. Did any of this feel familiar to you?
It felt familiar and yet foreign at the same time. So it felt, I've had a couple of friends growing up who themselves were Vietnamese refugees. And there were definitely parts of the story that I felt like I had heard through my friends' experiences or even just through hearing about their families. The parts for me that were very familiar were the whole male-female dynamic in their family. And familiar and foreign at the same time. I think women in Chinese culture are not as important or seen as important as men, right? Like in very traditional Chinese culture, the man, he holds the lineage of the family. And so boys are much more wanted than girls are and all of that stuff. And I think most of us are pretty familiar with the whole one child policy and how a lot of girls were getting aborted because of this. And just that's just kind of a cultural belief. And when I was reading this book, the pressure on the men in the book to keep the family safe, to keep things going, and kind of like the societal pressure was very familiar to me. What was a little foreign to me, though, was how fucked up a lot of these guys were.
Yeah, the grandpa was a tool.
Yeah, the grandfather was a gambler. He was an abusive husband. He was sleeping with prostitutes, right? Like, her father was also, I mean, I understood it later on as we got deeper into the story of kind of him slipping into a depression. But in the very beginning, he just seemed like he was also kind of like a complete loser that was dependent on her mom.
Because that's how they start with him. And then they do the backstory.
Right.
Yeah.
So there was this interesting moment of me reading this and being like, okay, I can totally get why it was really up to the women. The women weren't powerless, but they just didn't have as much say, I think, with a lot of the negotiations that would happen outside of the family. I thought it was really interesting that her grandmother, was it her grandmother that snuck opium away? Because that's what was the most valuable at the time. Yeah.
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 That was interesting. Yeah.
So kind of like the way that women found their power in these covert ways, because that's all they had, right? They wouldn't have been able to go and find a sailor to get them off of the island. They wouldn't have been able to negotiate in these public places, but they could carry some opium, because that would give them some leverage in certain private conversations. I thought that was really fascinating.
Those little details about how they survived, right? It's not just dodging bullets. It's those nuances of she's using opium as currency, and then when it gets destroyed, you know, she has to go back to her ne'er-do-well husband. Mm-hmm. Those touches of those details about how the family actually was able to survive in Vietnam was unusual and something I've never seen depicted before.
Yeah.
The father stuff, as we're jumping on page 68, this photo of the dad, Ba, walking down the hallway at the cheap apartment with the daughter just kind of like trailing behind him. That idea of dissonance, Sharon, is, I can't speak to other people's relationships with their parents, but like growing up, my dad was this foreign, I don't want to say he wasn't warm, but this mystery. We didn't know much about his backstory. We just knew dad was strict. Mm-hmm. Dad had moods. And my dad was great. He was a great father. But it wasn't until as a teenager and as adult, I started to learn more about his story leaving India, leaving everything. And it's that kind of unpacking, you know, because that's how you meet her dad. The first time you meet her dad as an adult and parents are divorced because, you know, Asian parents didn't get along. And then as a little girl, you start with her dad as a little girl. And he's this like guy who sits in the corner when mom goes to work because he doesn't want to go to work and he just smokes. And again, that's not my dad, but just this like person who's quiet and stoic. And I'm a little bit scared of him, right, as a little kid. And then she just dives into why is he this way? And you see pictures of him as a little boy and all of just the terrible thing, the traumatic things this guy had to endure, as did many Vietnamese people, right? But it's just like this backstory. I think the dad might be my favorite character. I mean, the mom's also a favorite character, but she came of privilege and she left it all behind. I think the parents are my favorite characters, yeah, far and away, just because it made me think about, without getting to my own parents' story, and it was nowhere near as extreme as what T's parents had to go through, but my parents went through some shit, right? Be it partition, Idi Amin, all these things. And I'm like, God, I don't know. I kind of want to do a book like this about my parents.
I was actually going to ask you about your parents' story, but at the higher level, when you talked to your dad about where he came from, how much did it change your understanding of how he was to you as a father?
Now that I'm it's funny, if you asked me that question before I was a father and after I was a father, because I think about this all the time now, because I have a 4-year-old, and before I was a father, I got it, but I didn't relate to it. So as a kid, dad's mean, dad's strict, dad's quiet, dad doesn't talk. We don't know much about dad's family. Then teenager, college, 20-year-olds, he starts to reveal more. I go back to India with him. I find out he's estranged from his family. Even my mom's own refugee story, right? I start to unpack these things like, oh, wow, that's different. Oh, that makes sense. I can connect the dots, but I would never be like that. And now, as I think about what my parents did when they were in their 20s, right? And starting a family, moving to a country, they didn't speak the language, or was pretty racist, all of these things. And what I was doing in my 20s. And like, it's so funny, Sharon, like, sorry, the episode on our other podcast that we're going to air tomorrow or this week is about this girl, Lulu. And she talks about her parents' journey, right? Having to work on like a college professor, having to work under the table. And I feel like I reek of privilege when I try to relate to my parents and everything they went through. And I don't think that's unique. T has that feeling. I know you guys probably do, one or two generations back. I think every American has that. Like, we are standing on the backs of, sorry, I'm getting a little preachy and we should get back to the book, but like, I guess this book really brings it home. My own privilege, our own privilege as Americans, that this is what we stand on the back of.
You kind of asked Sharon earlier about how familiar this was, and she kind of said some of it was very familiar, some of it not. And I was thinking about that too, about my family's immigrant story. I was born here. My mom came here on a boat, and neither were really refugees. I guess the closest was my paternal grandfather, who came here because his dad wanted him out of China because the Japanese were invading. So he kind of got out before the shit hit the fan. But there was a lot of wheeling and dealing that they had to do in order to get him here, because initially he was illegal. Yeah. It wasn't, he actually came here. Sharon, are you familiar with the paper sons?
Yep, absolutely. My grandfather was a paper son.
Same with my grandfather.
So, oh, wait, explain it to the rest of us. Explain it really quick.
So in 1904, big earthquake takes out San Francisco. The fire destroys all of these records, including the records of the people, the Chinese immigrants. And what follows is this sort of cottage industry where the Chinese who have settled in America can suddenly claim, oh, so-and-so in China is my brother or my sister or my son. Exactly. And so they would be sons on paper. You pay somebody, you're a son on paper, and then you come to America under the guise. In my father's case, the last name, I think, was Lowe. So my last name is Joe. His last name, when he came here, he pretended to be related to a man named Lowe. And he had to memorize all sorts of weird, esoteric trivia about this fellow Lowe's life. Like, the immigration officers would ask him things like, how many bathrooms were in your house? What story were they in? How many windows were in the bathrooms?
Yeah,
what was the orientation of... He had to memorize all of that shit. And wow. And he did, actually. He had a really sharp memory. I kind of only knew him as he was kind of, you know, older. But kind of looking at how well he performed, we got a FOIA. We put in a FOIA request a while ago, so we got the transcripts of those interviews.
That's so cool.
Just reading at how sharp he was and how much he was able to memorize that stuff and recite it under pressure, because he's there with the immigration officer, and if that immigration officer didn't let you in, you're going back to China, and here come the Japanese.
It's literally a matter of life and death.
Yeah, and I was blown away at his ability to do that. So he didn't have this constant warfare happening when he left, I don't think, but the stakes were still high, and he had to kind of find his own way. He had to finagle his way in. It wasn't a very clean process, as it was similarly to T. Bowie's family.
Yeah.
I'm glad you brought it back, because Ryan, it felt like Sheridan, my podcast, was hijacking this podcast.
Honestly, I kind of figured it would, though, because this, I think we all had a very personal response to this book. I mean, we can talk about the art and how good of a storyteller T. Bowie is, but it's the personal resonance that makes this book matter to us.
Yeah, it's funny. On the other show, we've interviewed a number of Vietnamese American guests. And as a thank you, I actually want to send a copy of this book. Because most people don't read comics, they're not familiar with it. And I feel like every culture in America has one or two stories that, if I wanted to explain the Indian American experience, I'd be like, hey, go watch Never Have I Ever on Netflix. That's the most accurate. And I feel like there's actually a couple other comics specifically that tell the Vietnamese American story so well. One thing I loved was how easy back then, and again, she came over, I think she was born in 75. I think she came over as like a 5 or 6 year old. So she came over in the 80s, around the time we were born. And back then, it was super easy for family to sponsor other family.
Yeah.
I remember that as well. Like, my dad single-handedly sponsored so many members of my mom's family to come to this country. And again, to make it political, that's not happening anymore. It's really hard to come here now. Even if you have family, even if you are married, even if you have 10 degrees, like how the parents had all these advanced education degrees and that didn't matter when they got here. I think there's one part where the dad's like, we should study this, or we should go to America because we speak French. Like, the decision of what country to go to from the refugee camp in Malaysia. There's just so many moments like that ring true or uncovered something. Like, I asked my dad, why'd you come to America? Why versus Britain or Canada or whatever, right? And to see their negotiation with where should we go.
What did he say?
It seemed cooler.
That's simple.
It wasn't as significant as in this book. And I remember asking my mom more recently, part of my interview project that you guys were part of, because mom had multiple suitors, right? It was a semi-arranged marriage. And there was one Canadian guy, one Australian guy. And my mom was like, your dad seemed nice in America. I'd heard a lot about it.
I never knew that your parents were in a semi-arranged marriage. Wow.
Yeah. And this marriage, in this book, it's a love marriage.
Are you talking about the mother and the father?
You're talking about T or her parents?
Here's what I'm saying. I don't know if arranged marriage is a thing in Vietnamese culture, but she didn't want to be married. And she kind of, well, he's depressed and he's going to die. I should give him a happy 2 years. That was some like dark, deep shit.
She got pregnant, I thought.
Yeah. Yeah. They had not a shotgun wedding, but she got pregnant before.
Oopsie baby. Well, no. Oopsie baby.
But they were dating. She went back home or something. He got really sick.
That's true.
And she was like, I'm going to make his last couple of years really nice.
She did say that. She said at some point that she only married him because she didn't think he would live very long or something like that.
Yeah. So to me, it's a marriage because she accidentally gets pregnant, probably when they're just fooling around being college kids. And then, it's mostly because she's just trying to be nice. She marries the guy just because she doesn't really feel good about saying no, because he's probably dying. And I think it's interesting to see T's reaction to that also, because she has this line where she says, it always seemed my mom was happiest before we came around and before she married my dad. Yeah. Mm-hmm. but really brutally honest. I actually thought that was really striking. The life that the mother lives as this kind of independent, glamorous, single woman doing her thing. And then how quickly that changes, not just because she gets married, but also because of this upheaval that happens throughout the country, mm-hmm. this constant colonialization with the French and then the Americans. It just kind of forces her into this one area. She's just trying to survive, and there's only one area, there's only one path you can take, and you got to get married to this guy, and you got to stay married, and you just got to keep moving. It was interesting to me how all of that upheaval just cut off all of the pathways, how their options were just like, there's only one option right
now.
Go to page 196 in the bottom right corner, and it basically is like, it turns out he got better. And that one panel where above it, it's the mom saying he got better, and like the look of despondence in. There's just like so many gut punch moments.
She's wearing her wedding dress too. I mean, that's a great photo, great image.
Yeah. So many moments like this that are just like, you know, it isn't a fairy tale. And I guess everyone's story is, I mean, it's just, yeah, nothing is a fairy tale.
No, it does seem like all of the important decisions were made for survival, right? Including who do we marry? Where do we live? What do we do next?
Yeah. That was just kind of, I don't know, what was so, you know, it's just something that you don't really think about when you don't see the story from the refugee's perspective. When, as you know, as often depicted in Hollywood, these people are just kind of scurrying around and the story is from the soldier's mm-hmm. perspective. Mm-hmm. But understanding that they had a life before you assholes came into town with your machine guns, and how much of that life just gets obliterated and closed off, how much of that potential is lost of what they could have been. I mean, they definitely succeeded in America, right? They were able to get their children to prosper, and the children now have families, but even still, what they could have, where their lives could have gone if they weren't always trying to escape.
Well, I feel like every hardship depicted, every scene of just struggle, for the most part is, I think what she's trying to say is, my parents took it in stride, because it's from one thing to the next thing to the next thing, and they just keep going forward because they have no other choice. You just got to find a way. Opium's gone, find a thing. Guy's boat failed, find a thing, you know?
I think they just don't have the luxury really to mourn and complain about, oh, if only I got into Harvard, or I got into Harvard and don't have to go to a state school. This is like, well, shit, this is what happened. I wish it didn't. But if, since survival is paramount, there's, you know, you got to move. You got to keep moving.
Oh, and I think it informs stoicism that her parents have now. That her parents in the modern day are very kind of, it is what it is. Like all the other shit going on in the world to her parents feels insignificant to what they went through. Our other guest, Sharon Lulu, talks about this. Like, there's like a big thing in Asian American culture right now about, why aren't our parents' generation more up in arms right now about BLM, Black Lives Matter? And it's not that they don't care. It's the stoicism of what they went through. And I'm not, again, it's not that our parents are saying no to Black Lives Matter. I just think they don't get as emotionally resonant as our generation does. Because our generation has kind of lived a cushy existence, our Asian American. So when we see the hardships of Black America, we're up in arms, but our parents are like, well, shit was real too for us. And again, it's a dangerous line of them saying that, but their perspective, as our friend Lulu said, was try to understand where they're coming from.
Well, I also think it's just because they're old and they're going through their own shit, their own health problems, their own problems with their own parents who have health problems.
Yeah.
And I think probably I'm projecting here or guessing here, but in their, from their perspective, they already raised their kids and left the world as it is, as it is now. And now it's up to the next generation. If you want to change it, it's up to the next generation to change it. I kind of get that sense, not from everybody, but from a lot of people in my parents' generation. I will say a lot of other people that I know, some neighbors, and even a lot of my aunts and uncles are very up in arms over the current state, but I think the older you get, the more problems you have. And sometimes those just take precedence over whatever societal change is happening, either outside your window in some other state.
Or maybe they've seen this happen so many times with so many different groups of people that this just seems like another chapter in the story instead of a big moment.
Yeah, I also wonder how many, there are a lot of iconic moments happening in recent months, really, a lot of big moments. And I'm wondering, one of the things that happens in The Best We Can Do is, There's a lot of unpacking of images and tropes that are commonly associated with Vietnam.
Like the guy being shot in the head by the general.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And they give the different perspective, which is, why was he shot? Why was he executed in the first place? And in giving that explanation, it emphasized how much that image, as shocking and horrifying as it is, was used as propaganda to further America's agenda.
Mm-hmm. But wasn't that the photo that, when it was seen by Americans, it really turned the tide of the anti-war movement?
I think so. I think that's what it says in the book.
Yeah, that's what it says in the book. I can't say, I was not, you know, I don't know from personal experience.
But yeah, again, to the point of it, that picture was used to say, look at the atrocities that are being caused. And at the same time, we were executing someone who did a horrible thing. It was the realities of war. I want to come back to the art a little. One choice that T-Boy makes is in the color. And it's something, again, less is more.
Yeah.
There's literally three colors in this book. Black, white, and this orange, some gradation of this orange sepia.
I thought it was beautiful. I don't know. When I saw that color, it reminded me of sunsets in Vietnam. You know, it's a very choiceful color.
It's also the color of the Vietnam flag, which I think is probably intentional.
Red
as well.
Yeah.
And kind of just from a more practical standpoint, if you're trying to learn graphic storytelling and you're still figuring things out, it's probably a lot easier if you just color in red rather than have to use the full spectrum.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So Sharon, we're almost out of time. Any last thoughts on the book?
I'm glad I read it. And you guys have actually opened up my eyes to just comics as a format of storytelling now. Like, I kind of want to ask you guys for a whole list of what I should read next. What should I?
Oh, there's a spreadsheet.
Oh, good. Oh, I want to see your spreadsheet. Because this was just so satisfying in a way that I didn't expect. And it was just so quick to read, you know, like it was a really deep story and really heavy. It was meaty, but it just seemed like it went by so much faster because of the format. So I really enjoyed it.
Awesome. Well, Sharon, it has been a pleasure talking to you about, I guess we did talk about race and immigrants and stuff. So pretty much the same thing we do every week.
Thank you guys for having me and for getting me to read a comic book. And that's our show.
Like what you heard? Please subscribe, leave a review, and a 5-star rating on your favorite podcasting platform.
Now more than ever, people need to be hearing these stories. Please share our show with a friend or three.
Want to learn more or got something to share? Visit modmypod.com or email us, hi mom@modmypod.com.
You can also follow us on Instagram and Twitter at modminpod. We'd love to hear from you.
That's it for now. I've been Ramin Segal.
And I'm still Sharon Lee Tony.
Remember, we're all modern minorities out there.
We'll talk to you soon.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.